Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have Corvette Racing's Oliver Gavin, one of the more enjoyable folks in any paddock. Good dude, just a lot of fun, his own man. You might have heard me say or write in other places that I enjoy folks, and I guess men or women, it isn't specific to one gender, but I love folks where you can say that he's his own man. He absolutely stands up for whatever he believes, won't acquiesce just for the sake of being nice or making you feel happy. He's his own man, and I appreciate that. I like folks who push back and or hold firm to whatever it is that they believe. So this is the first part of two parts. We've yet to record the second part, but in this first part of our podcast, sat down with Ollie to speak about his lifetimes and career leading up to Corvette racing. I think for those in sports car land who love endurance racing, you know Ollie, what, five-time winner, class winner of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, Daytona 24, Sebring, just you name it. The guys won everything. But, you know, we know that, and we're going to get into that in part two, but I first learned of Ollie in British junior open wheel racing, followed his career intently when he won the 1995 British Formula 3 Championship. That was a thrill. Watched him from there, watched him in F3000 trying to make it to F1. Things didn't necessarily work out the way he had wanted. We were thankful to have him in sports car racing, but nonetheless wanted to just delve into what led Ollie to that fork in the road, and he does get into that a little bit, and what led him to sports car racing, and really that took off in North America. And then there's a story about him getting choked in an elevator. So we will let young Mr. Gavin tell that tale as we get into part one. Mr. Gavin, welcome to episode, I have no idea,
okay,
the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Your talent has always interested me, having followed your young career, I think back to maybe starting in Vauxhall Junior, something
Vauxhall
like
Lotus, so
okay,
yeah, 92.
Tell me about where racing came into your world, your hemisphere.
Okay.
Some of us get there through family connections,
yeah.
Some of us stumble into it.
So my father had started a business up with five other guys when my brother and I, my brother's 2 years older than me, but my brother and I were around about, I was 10, my brother was 12, and my dad was just flat out working all the time, and he wanted to find something that he could do with my brother and I over the weekends when he wasn't so busy with work. And there was a friend in the village who was racing karts, had just started racing karts, and my father was heavily interested in cars. His father had run two garages in the local town when the family had moved over from Ireland. And you know, there was that real passion for cars, and my father thought, okay, if we can see if we can do something in the sort of car racing world or the karting world. And so this friends of ours had a kart. We went along to Rye House in Hertfordshire, just north of London there, and had a go in the kart. My brother and I, both of us, had a go, loved it. And on the way home, my dad could see that we were grinning from ear to ear, so he said, okay, right, well, I'll look at buying one of these carts between all three of us. Wow. and see if where it goes. And so we had got a cart, we put it on the roof rack of the car, and we went around from big car park to big car park in the sort of the industrial estate that my father had his business. And we raced this car around there for a while, and then we realized we needed to get it to a racetrack. And so then we started going to Kimbolton and some other racetracks, Rye House in Hertfordshire. And then it developed from there. And we did six years of racing together as a family. So my dad would drive the van and two carts in the back.
That's
and
awesome.
My brother and I would you know, ride along with him, and then we'd turn up all these different events. And
any memories of the music playing while driving along? Because I remember some of the crazy. I used to hear way too much John Denver music when my dad dragged me around to races.
Dire Straits was a huge one. Brothers in Arms was just a massive. It was just like that was on in the cassette player the whole time.
Welded.
I think we had like three copies of it because we just kept wearing it out. It was played so much.
So do you love the Dire Straits now or hate them? You just
no, actually, I do. I still quite like them. And if you want to sort of like reminisce about that period, then you put that on and it brings the memories back. And so that's kind of fun to do. And yeah, we had some crazy times, some great times. And I got to know the likes of Dario during that period, Dario Franchitti, and Marino as well. We were racing the same age group and also David Coulthard a little bit. And there was many guys that I sort of – that you can sort of see and track how where their careers have gone.
Pretty amazing era.
Yeah, yeah. It was very interesting to be around. And then towards the end of my karting times, I did the World Championship a couple of times, Junior World Championships. The one I remember was in Laval, and I think it was 87. And that was the year that Jan won, Magnussen.
Bastard.
Yeah. And, I mean, when we turned up there, we just realized how far behind the game we were as a little operation, you know, and the carts and the engines and the tires and the...
Serious bit.
Yeah. I mean, and Jan was a factory Tony Kart driver. And, you know, I was just... So we had one chassis and, like, three engines that my dad had sort of put together, and we were just a very small operation, and we never stood a chance. So we didn't have much success that year.
Where did you get the first inkling that you had talent? Because it's one thing to do it as a fun family thing on the weekends, activity. There's usually a turning point for most drivers where they or someone else said, aha, this could be a little more for you. And if you think about other sports, a kid playing baseball doesn't necessarily hit a home run his first time swinging the bat or kicking a ball. Where did that fall for you?
Well, I mean, I'd always enjoyed racing karts, and I'd had some success, but nothing fantastic. Mm. I mean, it wasn't sort of like I was winning, you know, the British Championships every year, and I was going to the European Championships and cleaning up. It was the first year that I started racing cars that all of a sudden the penny started to drop, and I was thinking, actually, you know what? I'm now battling with all those guys that I was that were clearly in front of me in karting, and now I'm racing with them and having this, you know, really strong competition, whether it's with someone like Dario or Jan or you know, just running at the front, and I was winning races. And that first year in Formula First in 1991, Formula First.
Great cars. Well, pieces of shite.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they were great cars, but you know, it was a great learning year, and you know, I won 11 of the 12 races that I competed in that year, and actually I remember my teammate Glenn Tabor was my teammate that year, and he was the guy that I had contact with in that race that I didn't win that year. I basically took the left front corner off the car by running into him coming into clearways at Brands Hatch, and I was in that position because I'd stalled at the start, and I dropped right back, and then I was coming back through the pack, and my teammate was not necessarily making it that easy, but then why should he? And you know,
Glenn Tabor has a lifelong story. Yeah, I denied Gavin the perfect run.
Yeah, so that was the race that I lost, but no, it was you know, that first year, and then I then raced in Formula Renault and Vauxhall Lotus as well that year, and then I ended up winning the McLaren All Sport Young Driver of the Year award at the end of 91. And so I think by the end of that season, I thought, actually, you know what, I could, if I apply myself here and really have a good crack at it, and I get some luck, that I could maybe make a career of this.
And the McLaren Autosport Award, for those who aren't familiar with it, that was often a transformational thing. Not every driver that won it went on to great success, but there were many who that recognition, maybe that the light interaction on a test day, whatever it was, that did help propel some folks forward.
Yeah, you know, you look at the trend over all the years, and the guys that have won that award, and they've generally gone on and had some great success. Like you say, there has been one or two that haven't, but it certainly did help me. And you know, testing in the McLaren was great. A couple of years later, we finally got around to getting that, and you know, just the cachet that it carries, and you know, it was a big sort of calling card for quite some time. So, yeah, I mean, just even getting the award from Ayrton Senna was just amazing. You know, it was just extraordinary. Just, he was an absolute hero, still is, you know, my biggest racing hero, I suppose. And, you know, to be able to be on the stage and pick up the trophy and just even have that interaction with him was just was pretty special. So, and there's a picture at home that I have. It's almost, I think, one of the only racing pictures that we actually have in the house. It's of myself sitting in the McLaren and Ayrton on one side of the car and Sir Stirling Moss on the other side of the car. And everybody that comes in my house stops and looks at that and they go, who's the 12-year-old in the car? You know, funny. I recognise Ayrton and I recognise Sir Stirling, but who's the 12-year-old? You know, big hair and, you know, it looked like one of my boys, you know, one of my children. So,
well, as someone who stood on the top step of some very impressive podiums, it's cool to think that that photo, you know, has, deserves that type of honoring in the house.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to have, and it's always a good sort of talking point.
So I think most of the world knows you these days as Oliver Gavin, sports car ace, winner of many things. I think of you that way as well, but I also think of you as, why am I not talking to Oliver about his 15-year Formula One career? Let's talk a little bit about the mid-1990s, because you were absolutely going like gangbusters in the UK. Great 95 season in Formula 3, also some F3000 as well. Run me through that era, because it wasn't like you weren't trying to get to Formula One.
No. I think what really, looking back on it now, you know, there's many steps and directions and choices that you make. And, you know, at that time, I'd had two seasons in Formula 3, 1993 and 1995, that had both been very successful. And so much of about in racing is about timing. And by the time I'd won the championship in 1995... I think my timing was gone, and I didn't carry that momentum that I'd had from 93. If I'd stayed on and done the championship in 1994, I think that if I'd won it that year, I think that I could have propelled myself further on into Formula One. But my biggest problem was most probably my size, and
Your height.
Yeah, my height.
Okay.
Yeah, my
you perv. Yeah, just kidding.
Yeah, my height was proving to be a problem. Yeah. And many people were looking at that and going, well, you know, this is not going to be easy. And I was I'm a skinny lad. I'm slight. I'm not what you would call sort of strong and powerful. And so I think a lot of team owners and people who were in and around the sport at the time would go, well, one, how are we going to get him in it? You know, how is he actually going to run in the car? And two, he looks like he's not strong enough.
Mm.
And I think that worked against me. And I, you know, I tried to rectify that. I tried to do as much as I possibly could to get myself strong enough, fit enough. But ultimately, there's not much that I could do. And in terms of, you know, the length of my legs or, you know, that's how tall I am. And, you know, it was a number of years later that Sid Watkins, the professor from Formula One, you know, said to me, well, I could give you an operation and maybe take a couple of inches out of your legs if you want. And I thought that was, and he was half joking.
Yeah.
You know, but I declined. I said thank you very much. I said but you know, there's some things that you do for the career that you obviously love, and it's a huge passion of mine. But you know, you have to draw the line somewhere, and have an operation to take a couple of inches out of your legs, it's maybe not the best thing to do.
You might have to do that on some barge in international waters, because I can't think of any licensed hospital that would.
Well, you never know with Sid. He always had a special way with things, and I'm sure if I really wanted it to happen, I'm sure he could have made it work.
Good Lord. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Great guy.
So you win the 95 British Formula 3 Championship. Great battle with a friend we've spoken about, Elio Castroneves, who's gone on to great things here in America. Tell me about the transition from, okay, if I'm not going to follow in my hero's tracks to become a Formula One world champion, what do I do next? Was that a purposeful decision? This is my plan, how I'm going to move in a different direction? Or was it, did things fall together on their own?
No, it was the things sort of fell together a little bit on their own. And you know, I think sort of from this period of 1995 all the way through to 1999, I was in this real no man's land of what should I do? Should I stay trying to race single seaters and seeing how I could make things work in Europe? Exploring lots of different things in all kinds of different racing. I did a season in 96 in international touring cars, yeah, with Opel, and that didn't really work out. It was a tough season, and I was young and very naive.
Was IndyCar an option or a realistic option? Interest, I should say.
Well, I'd seen through 96, I'd raced with Dario, yep, and against Dario, and then he had got the jump in 97, I think.
Yeah, Mercedes.
With Mercedes, and I'd seen how he had done that, and I thought, okay, this is, you know, a fantastic opportunity for him, but I just couldn't see how I was going to do it. And so then I was bouncing around and scrabbling around in lots of different things all the way through to the end of the 90s. And it was really a point at the end of the 90s where I realized that I had to make a purposeful turn from stop trying to chase this lost dream of single seaters, where it just quite clearly wasn't going to happen for me, and I had to focus all of my efforts on everything on sports cars. And you know, by the end of 99 into 2000, I'd had a number of things sort of happen in the 5 years before that point. Whether I was the Pacific test driver in 1995,
the Great Pacific,
yes, with Keith Wiggins, and you know, that whole operation, and I was supposed to drive in the final race in Adelaide in 1995 after winning the Formula 3 Championship in that year and getting my super license and flying all the way to Adelaide, getting there, and then finding out actually no, I don't have a super license, I can't compete in the race. The seat fitting I've just done in the pits there at Adelaide, it's all for nothing. And
that was brutal.
It was a very, and again, it comes down to being just naive and young and not really recognizing, you know, the people, the deals that were in play and the powers and the way that things were being pulled around politically. And you just get chewed up as a driver. You get chewed up and spat out the other side, and you're just collateral damage to everything else that's going on. And you know, I think you can say that you can say that about, you know, my closest rival in 1995. You know, Ralph Furman. He was very much in the same boat.
Yeah.
You know, a few years later, when I think he did the stuff with Jordan, you know, he was pretty much chewed up and spat out the other side. And you know, the late and great Justin Wilson. You know, he looked like he was going to, of the three of us, he looked like he was really going to have the best run of it. But again, he got chewed up and spat out and thrown out the other side. But fortunately, he then got to come and race in IndyCar and continue his single seater dream. But you know, for me, you know, 95 was very difficult at that Adelaide race, and so Keith had tried to explain why things had happened, but you know, it's very difficult to try and reason with all of that and understand it all. And so at the end of 99, beginning of 2000, Keith was working at Lola Cars, and Keith was the sales director at Lola Cars at that point. And I went to see him in his office, and I said, Keith, is there any way you can help me to get to America to drive a sports car? And he said, okay, yeah, we've got some guys that customers that we've got, and the guys just bought a brand new car, a Lola B2K10, yeah, Scott Schubert, and he ended up getting me in the car. I had to bring some finance. I had to bring some finance to get myself in the car. And I basically took all of our savings, all of the savings that my wife and I had got squirreled away for, you know, whatever it was, whether it was house improvements or, but we basically took all of our savings and we bet it all on this one race at Homestead.
Always a sound investment.
Oh, it was.
Tell me about the pressure going into that, because like you said, this wasn't the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
No.
This wasn't a trillion people watching.
No,
it was an obscure event.
Yeah, it was a Homestead Grand Am race. And it was, you know, it was something that was, you know, not you know, a big event. You've just got, and I sort of was saying to Keith, Keith, is this, you know, what am I going to get from this? He says, well, you're just going to have to run with it and see what happens, and, you know, one step at a time. And I got there, I drove the car, loved the car. It's a great car. Lola did a fantastic job with that car, and qualified the car on pole. But then we got thrown out for a small technical infringement.
What was it? Do you remember?
Oh, it was I think it was the airbox was didn't conform. It was slightly loose, or I don't know. Something happened, and Phil Crichton, who was running the car, was devastated. You know, because he thought they had got everything buttoned up, but obviously he'd missed that. And so we got started at the back, and that was, you know, starting from the back was my sort of first experience of driving and racing in sports cars in America, and I was having a great time. Came through the pack, and I think I got ourselves up into second or third, and then I had a bit of a run-in with Jack Baldwin.
Jack Baldwin.
Yeah, Jack Baldwin was driving, I think, for the 76 car. I think it was the ranch people.
Oh yeah. 74 Ranch.
Yeah, 74 Ranch. And so he was driving for them, and I came up...
George Robinson,
that's it. Came up against him, and we had a bit of wheel banging. Obviously, I was this young British punk coming over, and Jack didn't want to take any crap from me, so we had some wheel banging. He got a puncher. He comes around, goes nice into the pits. And he then comes back out of the pits after his tyre change, and he drives around very, very slowly until I come around. And he then ended up running sort of me off the road, and then I picked up a puncher. And I then had to go in, and I did a driver change at that point, and I jumped out. Scott Schubert jumped in, and then... as I was talking to Phil Crichton, he said to me, "Do you know who Jack Baldwin is?" And I said, "No." I said, "I've no idea." He says, "Well, he's not very happy with you." And I went, "Okay, right." And I was sort of all sort of pumped up and full of adrenaline. And I said, "Oh, who's this Jack Baldwin anyway?" And he then pointed him out as he was marching down the pit lane towards me. And I went off and ran off and hid in the truck. I was a bit of a girl.
Leave Jack alone.
Yeah, but it came back to haunt me though, because I then, later on in the season, I was at Three Rivers, and I ended up, I was in the hotel coming down in the lift, and I'm on the top floor, and it's gone down to the third floor, and it's stopped. Doors have opened, and Jack Baldwin gets in, and I'm on my own in the lift. And as the doors close, Jack turns to me and he grabs me.
By the throat?
By the throat. And he says some pretty choice words. And he says,
"Son,
don't you ever do that again." And we talked through the incident at Homestead. And he left me in no doubt where he stood on the whole thing. And it was quite, again, another bit of a wake-up call for racing in America and how things were going to be. And, you know, this is sports car racing, and this is the way we do things over here. You know, you don't mess around with these guys. And, I learned a bit of a lesson that day. But from that moment on, Jack and I have got on brilliantly.
Of course.
And, great respect for everything that he's done, and I think he has respect for everything that I've done. So... it was just sort of one of those moments. But when I got out of the lift that day in Three Rivers, I was completely pale, almost see-through. You know, I thought, God, I've just got away with my life. You know, I thought he was going to beat me to a pulp.
Yeah, yeah. No, Jack, no one's ever accused Jack of being anything less than a man. I mean, he's,
He's certainly not shy, is he?
No, not at all. So tell me about how that event, because I do remember, you know, you impressed quite a bit. So from that standpoint, the goal, the investment you made in yourself, I think it paid off. But did you feel at the time that it paid off, or did you get some of the recognition or calls from others as you started to look a year or two ahead?
I think it was a slow burner to start with. And I know James Weaver... was amazing in that period. I mean, that first weekend at Homestead, he came and sought me out. He came and found me. And, you know, he sort of wanted to give me some advice. And he was keen to sort of have me involved in the Dyson setup. And so it really took me aback and how sort of friendly he was, how nice he was, how accommodating he was, how much, you know, guidance and advice he was giving me. And Andy Wallace was much the same. And it was really kind of a bit of a breath of fresh air, because, you know, somewhat in some ways in Europe you're battling and fighting the whole time, and it's very cutthroat.
Knives out the whole time.
Yeah, and where I came to the US, and all of a sudden, you know, there was a James and an Andy and Dyson Racing, and as well as Intersport and others, who seemed to be very sort of welcoming and sort of friendly, and the Jameses and the Andys gave me lots of advice, but the person who got me through the next year and a half was John Field, and driving the Banana Joe's car was fantastic fun. And there was many, many stories and many crazy things happened, you know, where John arriving back in the pits with only the gear stick in his hand, or, you know, coming back with just the steering wheel in his hand, or, you know, that was
a fairly typical John Field stint.
Yeah, it was. And you knew that if you could just get in the car during the race, that had been a sort of like a major result, you know. Then if you could get the thing to the end and actually end up, finishing the thing, then usually you would end up finishing on the podium, if not winning it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it was book the flight with a flexible departure.
Yeah, there's
3 o'clock will be fine. No, we're not going to be here that long.
Yeah. But, you know, John was massively generous. And, there was another guy at that point, Martin Dixon, who was running Intersport with John. And Martin was very, very pivotal in making all of that work as well. And he was sort of batting on my side, because when John would have a bit of a bad weekend or a bad week and he would be not so sure about who was going to drive the car with him, you know, Martin would always be batting for me and saying, well, why don't we get Ollie in the car again and see if we can get a good result this weekend. And, you know, and it was a pivotal point. And, you know, I'd be coming to the race and I'd usually end up flying out with James and Andy, and they'd sort of put a bit of an arm around me and sort of show me the way and, you know, give me some guidance, or, you know, just end up sort of trying to educate me in the ways of racing sports cars in the US. So
you had a brief interlude in a saline. Tell me where Corvette Racing comes into the conversation. Where is that point of contact made? How does that come together for you?
So I was driving through 2000 with John, and then 2001 I continued to drive with John Field and Intersport, and then Celine approached me at the start of 2001 and said, we'd like to try and get you in a car, we'd like to try and get you in a Sebring for the 12 hours. And it was off and it was on, it was off and it was on, and then I got the call to say, yeah, it's on, and I'd be driving with Franz Conrad and Terry Porcella. Got there, things went really well for a brand new car, seeing as this car had hardly done any testing at all around such a brutal track like Sebring. You know, everybody was saying, yeah, it might be fast, but it's never going to last. Well, qualified on pole, that was great. Franz decided he was going to start the race, and Terry and I were standing there watching the pits, and Franz is roaring around and not really necessarily looking in the mirrors.
I love Franz.
Yeah. And the rear deck was hanging off, and it was just only on by one catch, and Terry and I were screaming and saying, look, if this thing flies off, we're out of the race, we have no spares, there's no spare deck, there's no spare anything. Eventually the team managed to get through to Franz on the radio. Franz came into the pits, but he'd already been on the radio back to the team to say, okay, I need these tools lined up, and he was going to fix the car when he came in. So classic old school way.
Yeah.
You know, the car hasn't even stopped, and he's got the door open, he's out, and he's then trying to fix it himself. He's got the tape the lock wire, the pliers, the cutters, everything. He's got this rear deck back on secured, taped it all up himself. There's not even another mechanic allowed to touch the car.
The mechanics are standing there going, should we get you a sandwich? What, can I help you?
And then before you knew it, he jumped back in the car, strapped himself back in, and roared off out the pits. And Terry and I were both standing there open mouth, just thinking, what happened just then? Fran just fixed the car single-handedly.
Yeah.
And we went on to win the race and beat Corvette. And I do remember I came in for my last pit stop when I finished the race. And I remember Doug Feehan and Robin Pratt sitting on the pit wall watching our final pit stop and hoping it was going to go wrong.
Sure.
And that was, I think that was the first point where I came on the Corvette radar. And then I then went on to do a race at Watkins Glen with John Field and in the Intersport car. And we finished on the podium. And Ron Fellows was giving out the trophies. And Ron said, as he gave me the trophy, he said, "Have you got a minute after the podium presentation?" He says, "I want to just have a quick chat."
Nice.
Okay, great. Okay. So came off the podium, and then Ron said, "Look, I think that there could be an opportunity with us coming along." He said, "Why don't you have a chat with Doug Feehan? Here's his number. Give him a call." And so I did. When I got home, I gave Doug Feehan a call, and then I then went to the Laguna Seca race at the end of the year. I wasn't racing. I wasn't driving. In fact, actually, I was just helping John Field in the Intersport car, and I was, I don't know whether I was engineering, I was part team manager, I was just really doing anything just to be there, because I knew if I could get there,
yeah,
I could then meet properly with Doug and then do the deal for Corvette, and I did the deal for Corvette Racing for 2002 that weekend at Laguna with Doug, and got it all buttoned up. And then Feehan said, "Okay, well, we've discussed all the terms and everything, but this can't be final until Gary Pratt's seen you drive one of his cars."
Nice.
So in November of 2001, I had my first test at Sebring in the Corvette, and I think within 10 laps, Gary had sort of seen enough and said, "Okay, yeah, great, you're in." And so that was it. That was the start of the relationship with Corvette Racing. And so... yeah.
What was that feeling like for you coming off of 10, 12, however many years of trying to get somewhere, find a home?
Yeah.
Right? You'd been in series after series, teams, Megaland, I think.
Yeah, Megaland.
You can run through the name of relatively obscure teams you've driven for to try and get to someplace.
Yeah.
Now you had found a true home with a factory program. Was there a sense of satisfaction? What was that feeling like? Because you worked to get there.
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely a sense of satisfaction, but also a sense of, okay, pinch myself a little bit. Is this a fantastic, great opportunity for me? But also, I've got to work to keep this. I can't just think, made it now. Feet up, you know, just relax, just cruise around. I knew that I still had to work extremely hard, you know, whether that's on my work ethic with the team or with my fitness, or whether it was with, you know, my teammates and developing relationships with them, and you know, all of the discipline that you have to have as a sort of top sports car driver, and you know, all the time trying to improve yourself, make yourself better, learn all the time. That was one of the things that James Weaver impressed on me a lot. He said, "Never ever stop learning. Never ever think that you know it all. You have to keep soaking it all up." You know, whether that's the experience of a particular track or a car or a set of tires you're on or whatever it is. He said, "Never ever take it for granted that you know it all and that you can always learn something from someone."
Wow.
Mm.
So that team, that Corvette Racing team you joined at the time, was a bit old.
Yeah.
If I look at the driving roster, I mean, that program started off and said, "We're going after well-established stars, well-established champions." It was a gradual youthification, not a word, but there was a gradual move towards a little bit of youth of some of those drivers.
Yeah.
Maybe, it'll, you know, had reached their peak, if not saw it in the rearview mirror a little bit. What was the culture like back then for you? Again, I mean, you're not weren't incredibly young, but we're still young. And then what's it like today, knowing that between yourself and Magnussen, for example, you guys are the comparative old farts of the team?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at that point, I did feel like the real youngster coming in. And that first season that I did in 2002, you know, I think that both Ron and Johnny were sort of looking at me going, God, you know, who's this young guy coming in here and maybe trying to show us up or, you know, I didn't want to necessarily ruffle any feathers or make it difficult for anyone. But, you know, I was trying to establish myself as a sports car driver that, you know, wanted to have more than just a part-time role. I wanted to be full-time. And, you know, by 2003, I'd managed to get that opportunity, and I was assigned onto the four car. And Doug Feehan came to me at the end of 2002 and sort of sat down with me. I remember we were in the hotel in Beaufort there for Petit Le Mans. And it was a Friday, I think, and you don't do that much on a Friday, I don't think. I think it was then, and he said, look, Oliver, we want you for 2003, and we want you to lead the team, the number four car team. We want you to be the team captain on the number four car. So I was a bit, you know, taken aback, and then... And then he said, we're not sure who your teammate's going to be, but it'll be either Andy Pilgrim or Kelly Collins. And, you know, as things turned out, it was Kelly, and Andy was in for the longer races. And it was that sort of period where, again, I was trying to sort of still establish myself as a sort of like a full-time driver. And then, you know, by the time we got to 2004, it turned out that, you know, Andy and Kelly and Frank were all going to leave, and you know, the likes of Olivier, Jan and Max Pappas were going to come in, and it did turn things on its head a little bit for a while, but then my relationship with Olivier, you know, really sort of bedded in, and then we had, you know, Jan as our third, you know, and it seemed through that 2004, 5 and 6 period that even into 2007 there was some amazing races and some great victories. So, you know, it was a very satisfying part of my career, I suppose.
I think we're going to have to dedicate a part 2 to nothing but Corvette racing, because there's so much in there to talk about. Let's close on one of my favorite topics. Worst races.
Wow.
Right. I mean, I've seen you spray too much champagne, Gavin. There has to be a race, and I'm not talking about some, like, heartbreaking where you're crying afterwards, but every quality driver I know of has at least one race where they walked away going, really? Are you kidding me? Something, whether it was something breaking and something unfortunate, victory snatched away from you. There has to be some race from your history you're like, come on.
Yeah, well, there's sort of many. I suppose one of the hardest ones was 2009 at Le Mans. We'd battled and battled with a few different things, and I was driving with Olivier and Marcel Fassler, and we were racing super hard with our teammates. And Marcel was in the car. He got us into the lead, and things were looking really good. And we only had a very short period of time left in the race. I think we only had about an hour and a half left. And then Marcel comes on the radio and says, "I can smell gearbox oil and transmission oil, and it's not shifting right." And the team was like, "Yeah, it should be okay. It's looking all right, but see if you can make it round." And he stopped, most probably 6 or 10 feet short of the line to get over the line and into the pit lane, and then to be there's nothing that we could do. We couldn't touch the car. Marcel couldn't push it. It was just the rules. It's just super frustrating. It was just so galling, and it was so close, and that was certainly one of them that was sort of is very difficult to swallow at the end of that race. And I know Marcel came back afterwards and he was in tears. He was terribly upset, and he said he was so desperate to win the race. And I said to him, I said, don't worry, you'll get another chance. And of course he did.
Keep going, little fella. You can do it. Hey, those overall wins. Yeah, exactly. Can I have one of those trophies, buddy? Come on.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, yeah, he was a great teammate, great guy to have in the car. And so it proved this year, you know, just having him back in the car this year at both Daytona and Sebring, it's just been brilliant to have him back, you know, really, really fond of him. So.
Nice to kind of, I don't know if I want to say correct history, but with the success you've had this year in those endurance races, that is ties things up in a nice little bow.
It was, you know, certainly it finishes off some business that I think was a little bit unfinished with Marcel, so it's great.
Well, brother, really enjoyed this. We're going to have to do find time for a part two, because there's more fun tales to tell. Oliver Gavin, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Matt.
That was Oliver Gavin. Thanks for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at marshallproof.com.